Welcome everyone today to our internet webinar, which is on, it's part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar series, and sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Michelle Mahoney and I'm in the Superfund office. I'm going to moderate today's session. We're going to get started, like I said, in a few moments. So while we're waiting for other people to log on, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping items. And actually, if you move to slide two, you'll see some of the housekeeping items on the slide that I'm going to say to you verbally now. Basically, when you registered for this webinar, you were directed to a seminar-specific URL, which was the front page of today's seminar. And the front page contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have some pictures and bio sketches of the presenters, presenter contact information, email addresses are hot linked so that you can get right to the presenter that if you want to send them an email after today's presentation. We have people participating both on the phone and through the internet streaming. For those of you who are on the phones, I want to request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We are going to have some question and answer sessions, probably after each speaker. And at that point, you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, I ask that you take a moment right now and hit *6, and this will place your phone on mute. And then when we get to the point where you can ask questions, I'll remind you to hit *6 to unmute your phone. And basically, this just reduces the background noises that can disrupt the quality of today's audio transmission since we are recording this for future playback. And please don't put us on hold. A lot of organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So keep us on mute and don't put us on hold. So by now, each of you should have clicked on the agenda for today's go-to session icon. And you should be on you're either on slide number one or slide number two of the presentation. And this is the main page that contains the slides, above which you'll find navigation icons. Those are the orange buttons where you can submit questions by using the question mark icon. And please don't wait to submit questions. You can be submitting questions as the presentation is coming along. And that way, when we get to the question and answer session, we're ready to go and ask your questions. And we just encourage you to just keep using that question mark icon if you do think of something as the presentation's moving on. If you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use this question mark icon and let us know of what your technical difficulty is. Just include your phone number so we can reach you to try to help you troubleshoot your problems. And as the presenter is moving through their presentation, they're going to announce the number of the slide to which they're moving. And you can advance to the next slide by using the right arrow button above the slide, or you can also click on the appropriate slide number that's in the left-hand frame. So we're going to have a few question sessions. At the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through a page with some links to more information. And we also have a feedback form that we encourage you to complete, letting us know how you like the seminar and what ideas you might have for future webinars. We take this your feedback seriously, and it helps us planning and in what we're going to present on our CLUIN webinars. So with that, I think we're ready to start today's session. We have several presenters. Melissa Friedland is here, who's going to be doing the introduction. She's the Superfund Redevelopment Program Coordinator here at EPA. So I'm going to turn it over to Melissa to get the presentation started, and she'll be starting on slide three.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our first Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar of 2012. As Michelle said, my name is Melissa Friedland. I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment here at EPA headquarters. And Frank Avasato and I support EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. So today I'll be presenting with Bill Denman, Tom Bloom, and Chris Thomas from EPA, and Greg Griffith from the U.S. Soccer Foundation. We're going to talk about reusing cleaned up Superfund sites as soccer fields and our goal is to provide you with some examples that have been reused as soccer fields and take a close look at how communities work to reuse those sites and the key challenges and lessons they've learned throughout the reuse process. So next slide, which would be slide 4. Okay, great. Okay. I'll begin today by just spending a few minutes talking about SRI and the tools and resources we can provide communities and regions to help reuse their Superfund sites. And then I'll hand things over to Bill, who will be talking about soccer reuse at the Camilla Wood Preserving site in Georgia. We'll hear from Tom Bloom about the soccer fields at HOD Landfill in Antioch, Illinois. And Chris Thomas from the Aztec site. We'll talk about the Aztec site. And we'll conclude our case studies by talking to Greg Griffith, who's here from the U.S. Soccer Foundation. I'm thrilled that he's been able to join us, and he can talk about how the foundation can support communities, particularly in low-income areas in need of soccer fields. So thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Next slide, slide 5. Our mission at SRI at both national and regional levels is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. Next slide, number 6. When we first started, a lot of people called us the 4 P's, pilots, promotion, policy, and partnerships. And in fact, when we began in 1999, we picked 10 Superfund redevelopment pilots. We no longer do that, so we always get questions saying, do you have any more pilots? No, we don't. So we use an in-kind services contractor to provide support to communities. As far as promotion, we found out that one of the most effective tools we have is to share the stories of what's been done at other sites. And in order to spread the word, we've developed a lot of communication tools, and I'll be talking more about those. In our third P, policy, we've released a number of guidance documents on reusing Superfund sites, and we've worked with regions and other EPA offices on resolving reuse issues. And our fourth P, which is really very relevant to today, is that we've partnered with various organizations. So today we're talking about the U.S. Soccer Foundation. In 2004, we formed a partnership with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, and we already have AMA members flying model airplanes at 7 sites. So with that partnership, we've established a process where EPA informs member clubs, where AMA informs member clubs about how to find Superfund sites in their area, and it gives them a way for them to get basic information on the site and its possibilities as a flying site, and helps them get in touch with appropriate EPA staff, local officials, and landowners. Next slide, please. Slide 9. So how can... 7, sorry. So how can we help? We have a number of tools and resources available, and I'm just going to touch on those very briefly. Next slide. Slide 8. Communication is key. As I mentioned before, that one of the most effective tools we have is to share the stories of what's been done at other sites. And in order to spread the word, we've developed fact sheets, case studies, videos, brochures, and we have a great website with success stories and current information. And just in this past year, we've developed success stories for 8 regions. We also have several in-depth comprehensive case studies for anyone interested in understanding how the reuse process played out start to finish. So if you visit our website, you can see stories for HOD, for Aerojet, MDI, Milltown Reservoir, Diddale Slag, and former Spelman Engineering. Next slide. Okay. I mentioned our website briefly. It's the hub for most of our tools. And I just want to point out that we have a lot of videos up there, and they've become increasingly useful. So we post them on our website, and we provide them to stakeholders upon request, and we also use them at our trainings. Next slide. So slide 10. So let me just talk briefly about regional seeds. This is something we do to provide startup funding for reuse planning at Superfund sites. So I'll just take a minute and explain this process. Next slide, slide 11. To initiate planning projects, SRI provides regional seed startup funds around the country. And through this work, we've seen that well-run community-based reuse planning has the potential to dramatically improve community relations and the public's perception of the agency. We've also seen how we can streamline the remedial process by clarifying a site's reasonably anticipated future land use and integrating that with a site's remedial strategy. And we've also seen that this can bring the agency and communities together around more cost-effective remedies that produce the greatest long-term value for local communities. So we know that there's no one-size-fits-all strategy, and we offer several types of regional seeds to support reuse, ranging from full reuse planning processes to support to small exploratory seeds to see if reuse is a viable option. Next slide. Slide 12. Okay. Just take a minute and talk about the Return to Use Initiative, which is one of our primary efforts, and it's focused on construction complete sites or sites that are partly cleaned up. And the initiative has one major purpose, and that is to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. So as part of the initiative, we capture the lessons learned at the site and create demonstration projects so other cleaned-up sites can benefit from the experiences. And we make an effort to do what we can to address barriers and work with regions to find out ways headquarters could potentially help on a site-by-site basis. So under Return to Use, we provided regional seeds, we've identified and shared examples that promote lessons learned, and we've helped regions draft ready for reuse determinations. Next slide. Okay, which is slide 13. So just here's our contact information if you need it. I'm going to stop here and leave as much time as possible for our presenters, but if you'd like any more information about any of the tools and resources I've mentioned, please don't hesitate to contact me or visit our website. So next slide, which is slide 14. I'm going to turn things over to Bill, who's going to talk about the recreational reuse at Camilla Wood Preserving. And Bill, please go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you, Melissa. If you could all go to slide 15. That's kind of our introductory slide, and I just want to let you know, as Melissa said, my name is Bill Denman. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Coordinator in Region 4. I'm also a remedial project manager, which means I work on sites very similar to Camilla in getting them through the cleanup process, but kind of specialized in Superfund redevelopment. And also have with me Leo Francendisi. Leo was the on-scene coordinator for this site, and for those of you not familiar with the Superfund process, it's very common for our emergency response program to take an action at a site prior to the remedial program taking a more long-term action. A lot of times the emergency response people will come in and take the short-term actions necessary to stabilize the site and take care of anything that could cause a problem in the short term. And so Leo worked with the community on the emergency response removal action and coordinated with the reuse plans and helped get a lot of this implemented. So Leo, I don't know if you want to say anything before we get started or?
Sorry, I had to take you off mute.
Okay.
What I want to point out is, as Bill said, we often do upfront work on NPL sites for primarily source areas. There's a number of guidelines that we use to determine whether we will be spending money on an NPL site. This one was particularly unique at the time, because what we ended up with was land use on an active NPL site, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, that that hadn't been done up to this up to that point.
It's difficult, especially with the remediation that's significant as will happen on this site.
Right, and so that was one of the more unique opportunities, was that we had enough information to figure out that half of the site had a driving surface soil and groundwater risk, and then the other half of the site only had a surface soil risk. So we were able to carve out the surface soil risk part of the site and do most of the remediation work as a time-critical removal action. I'll add more as Bill goes through the slides.
Okay.
That's a good background.
Okay, great. I've asked Leo to stop me when I'm talking about the site and interject with important information as we go through the slides. But, you know, as he said, it's very it was very commendable on his part to work with the remedial side of the house and with the town of Camilla to incorporate what their reuse plans were into their into his emergency response action. We'll see how that was a success as we go through the go to the next slide, please. That's slide 16. A little background of the site. As you can see from this slide, there's a red boundary that outlines the boundary of the site of the former Camilla Wood Preserving Company. It's about a 40-acre site located in Camilla, Georgia, which is a small town, about 5,700 people, located in southwestern Georgia, about 60 miles north of Tallahassee, Florida. Wood preserving activities at the site occurred between 1947 and 1991, and that resulted in the contamination of site soils with dioxin, pentachlorophenol, creosote, and polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. Next slide. So from 1991 until 1997, EPA was involved initially with removal actions to abate immediate threats to human health and the environment that included decommissioning and dismantling operations, removing and solidifying on-site structures, and then removing and replacing contaminated soils from four residences. In 2002, the city of Camilla initiated a community-based reuse planning process for the site using support resources that EPA provided. Initially, we had pilots, and this was one of the first times we had changed from, we started out in the Superfund redevelopment process by having people compete for grants that could be used to fund reuse planning processes, and kind of had mixed results because it was such a new concept. People who understood Superfund sometimes didn't understand redevelopment very well, and people who understood redevelopment very well didn't necessarily understand the limitations of a Superfund site, and so this was one of the first sites in our region where we, instead of giving a grant, we gave $50,000 in contractor services through E-Squared, now Skio Solutions, to assist the city of Camilla in planning for the reuse of the site. In 2006 to 2007, the community had to update their reuse plan. We'll talk about why that happened here in just a minute. And that was updated in time for EPA's planned additional removal action, which is what Leo conducted. And during that removal action, soils were excavated and remediated on-site to recreational standards because that's what we, you know, had planned for the site to be, a recreational use. The remaining pole barns and contaminated soils lining the drainage ditch zone on the western half of the site were also addressed. And then fencing was installed between the eastern and western halves of the site, as Leo said, to separate those areas that had soil and groundwater impacts to those areas that just had soil impacts. In 2009, EPA issued the Record of Decision for the site, which included on-site stabilization solidification of contaminated soils in the source area, on-site stabilization solidification of the top 2 feet of contaminated soil outside of the highly contaminated source area, sealing of highly porous subsurface features, installation of a vertical barrier wall around the perimeter of the source area, and monitor natural attenuation in the areas of the surface. Superficial aquifer that are located outside of the vertical walls. As you can see, that combined with some stormwater improvements, some on-site chemical oxidation, and there's a lot of remediation that will be required in this other area. But in the area that just had soil impacts, it was the development of the site into recreational uses was able to occur. Next slide, please. In 2002 to 2003, as we said, the city of Camilla established and worked with a community-based land use committee and a consultant team, which was E-Squared, to develop a conceptual reuse framework plan. During a six-month project period, this committee discussed and defined reuse properties for the site and concluded that the most appropriate reuse of the site would be a park that would serve the needs of Camilla's residents and visitors. Site staff from EPA, the Georgia Environmental Protection Division, provided information and served as resources for this committee. And the reuse plan, after it was developed, was presented to the Camilla City Council in June of 2003 and included the following components. It included a community park, recreation and community facilities, a fire and rescue training area, which was a need at the time of the first reuse plan, tree rows, and some bioswales. But by 2006, prior to the time-critical removal action taking place, several conditions had changed. For example, a fire and rescue training facility had been built in a nearby community and was therefore no longer needed, but their need for new soccer fields had grown rapidly.
Next slide, please.
So let me jump in
there. Okay.
I was also the project manager during that period, the 2003 period. I really need to emphasize that. In the community's mind, it takes a little while for the vision to become reality in their mind that they will actually be listened to in terms of what they consider important to their community. It's almost like you have to demonstrate credibility by letting them be active participants in deciding what's good for the community, what's not good for the community, what we can afford in terms of remediation also balanced against what the community wants. And I just want to emphasize that because in the beginning, they really didn't feel, often overused word, empowered, but as they began to realize that they were making their own choices, this changed the attitude of an environmental justice community to be far more positive about an unused piece of property. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, thanks, Lee. I appreciate that. All right, we're on slide 19 now. And you can see from this photo, you can kind of see the reuse plan and the areas on the western portion that are recreational. You see where the RV park is and then some area for soccer fields. But notice on the right-hand side of the major road there that this property, well, first of all, it's surrounded on three sides by residential, and across the street is right across the street from the local high school. So while this facility had operated for so many years, it certainly didn't make sense for it to continue in a commercial industrial type of scenario, and that, I think, was one of the things that drove the eventual reuse of this to be more consistent with surrounding land uses. The Land Use Committee determined that the site would be an ideal location for a soccer complex, given its close proximity to major access roads and to the high school and residential neighborhoods, as I said. The committee also identified the need for basketball courts, walking trails, a flexible open space, a small RV park, and potential use of the existing office building for the Mitchell County Parks and Recreation Department. In 2006, though, the community updated its reuse plan for this site to reflect the rapidly growing local demand for new soccer fields and initiated a youth soccer program in support of a youth soccer program that was initiated in 2004. Youth League registration has more than doubled to 120 participants. So the community would also wanted to extend the Youth League across Mitchell County and establish an adult soccer league. So you can see that this was kind of a catalyst for additional recreational plans that the county had overall. And so that a lot of times we see that in the redevelopment of a site, that it can kind of be a catalyst or an anchor to promote future beneficial uses across an area, a county or a city. Next slide, please. There were some challenges that the city faced in trying to acquire the property. This was an abandoned piece of property. They didn't own it. So after evaluating different acquisition options, the city determined that involuntary acquisition, which covered an explicit liability exemption under Superfund law, would be the best route for them to take. They had two property tax foreclosure options. One involved a judicial action and the other was an administrative proceeding. And while the judicial action would provide the city with unhindered title to the property, it was very lengthy, and it would have meant delaying an opening of the park. So they chose an administrative proceeding, which provided the city with title to the property immediately, but that the property, the caveat there is the property would be subject to a redeemable interest for a 12-month period. So in theory, this meant that any parties with a legal interest in the property could assert their claims regarding ownership, even if they'd already started work on the recreational facility. But the city, given the fact that the property taxes owed significantly exceeded the market value of the land, the city felt like it was unlikely that anything like that would happen. So they concluded that proceeding with construction of the park during the redemption period was acceptable risk, and ultimately the city went forward with the administrative proceeding, which allowed them to go ahead and take ownership of the property. And in August of 2007, the city successfully took clear title to the property.
Let me just jump in there.
Okay.
Another moment, Bill. That was, by the way, that was the key fear that needed to be overcome for this to become successful, was to figure out a way that the city would get this without the liability. And the involuntary acquisition was the key piece that made all the other pieces come together. Once that happened, other things started to become available to the redevelopment, such as free labor for laying sod. I think we got sod at cost. They donated irrigation systems from the local community vendors. Shrubbery was also at cost. People wanted to become part of something that was traditionally a decade's blight. It really was the key piece. If you're really going to engage any success with the community, they realistically need to have some promise or coverage from the agency that they will not be liable. And so that piece about involuntary acquisition, not making them liable, was the most important piece to all of us. Thanks, Bill.
That's a really good point, Leo, and it's something that local governments struggle with a lot. And we've used some of the tools that Melissa talked about to try to allay some of the concerns that local governments have regarding, either in this case the liability of a site where significant remediation is going to occur, or convincing people or informing people or helping the local government inform people that those parcels or the property that has been cleaned up is protected now to use as a park. And so we do have tools that we use to try to allay those concerns. But the more that can be, layered on, and that I think I completely agree is critical, because that's one of the major challenges I see for local government is that liability concern. Okay, next slide, please. So the key stakeholders in this, as Leo said, was certainly the community, getting them involved, getting them to feel ownership, and that they had, some say into what was going to happen and that they could participate. The city of Camilla obviously was a major player. They had a vision for the property, and one of the things I've noticed in my 10 years or so experience in doing this is that there's always someone or some group that has a vision and really works hard to produce that vision in every successful redevelopment. It doesn't just happen. It needs somebody behind pushing it, and I think in this case certainly the city of Camilla was a major a factor in this happening. The community-based land use committee certainly served the purpose in helping, talk about ideas and, how do you, do we need a fire rescue training facility? Do we need an RV park? Do we need soccer fields? Do we need open space? How do we best plan for the use of this? Mitchell County, which is the county that Camilla is in, and their Parks and Recreation Department certainly worked in conjunction with the city as well. And then EPA, we of course provided contractor services to help put all this together, and whatever tools we had at the time, which sometimes, one of the things we overlook sometimes as a tool is just providing staff people to be able to talk to them. Like I know, Leo spent a significant amount of time working with them on reuse plans and how that would coordinate with the cleanup and how things were going to happen, and just taking the time to help educate them so that they could plan for the construction, and then coordinating our activities and making the effort to coordinate our activities with their plans so that it could be successfully implemented. Not to mention, also our legal folks. I know spent a lot of time, talking with the city of Camilla city attorney and how, this involuntary acquisition could occur and what that would mean. Next slide, please. So how did this funding occur? I think we've talked about that a little bit, but as I said, this was a pilot project that it was the first time in our region that we used contractor services instead of a grant. Now that's pretty much how we do it. I think that's certainly, having a group come in that understands the intricacies and complexity of a Superfund site and land use and redevelopment is critical. Next slide. These are just some shots before use. It wasn't always filled with water. I understand this photo was taken after a heavy rain, but as you can see, there were certainly some stormwater issues. Those highlight the pole barns that were taken down to make way for the soccer fields. Some of the other pictures are pictures of what was left over from the creosote operation. Leo, I don't know if you want to add anything before reuse.
No, I think I I've touched on the main issues. I just want folks to remember that this was land use that was accomplished on an active NTL site.
Right.
The
right, with future work scheduled on parts of it. Sure.
Correct, and that we actually had to separate the break down the site in terms of what's both groundwater and soil impacted by versus what's just soil impact. Unfortunately for this site, it was kind of a half and half deal. The half that was just soil impacted ended up being reused. There's a tremendous amount of vision out there for folks who want to reuse dead pieces of property, but we as an agency need to help them figure out how to overcome the liability fear. Once that happens, you know, folks know what's best for them, and, you know, they'll figure it out pretty much on their own if you just stand back. And then, you know, that little magic moment happens where folks start donating free labor, free equipment. They want to be part of success, and it's almost like you can't hold them back anymore. The key piece is overcoming the liability fear.
I completely agree. Next slide, please. Here's some slides of our success after the soccer fields were built. They opened in September of 2007 on schedule. The Mitchell County Recreation Department operates the community parks and plans to expand the Forts complex on the eastern half of the site after we complete the long-term remediation. It moved its park management operations to the remaining building on site. This is an example of EPA's partnership with the community, allowing the site cleanup and reuse to be integrated. The local government's innovative, flexible approach to the acquisition of the site and the county's cooperation, these were all key factors in providing this new recreational opportunity for residents and visitors of this area. Next slide. So lessons learned, I think we've talked about some of these. Certainly reuse planning is the nexus where we can identify what type of use is planned, and that can be used to coordinate with the remedial actions that are taking place as far as, you know, how it's conducted, how it's designed, how it's implemented to make sure that it happens at the same time or happens in conjunction with the reuse. It certainly benefits the reuse planning and the potential to provide alternate approaches to remedies and lower a remediation cost. You know what the future use is going to be of the site. It also helps us in our community relations requirement, which under Superfund, of course, we're required to do certain community outreach and community involvement. And I can't think of a better way of involving the community than to, you know, bring them in and have them be a part of determining how this property will eventually be reused after we're done with our cleanup for years and years to come. So it also gives the community, I think, you know, and Leo talked about this some, I think it gives the community something positive to think about in the future, because oftentimes these sites have been vacant for a long time. They've had stigma. They've had maybe real health impacts or contamination issues that have concerned people. And now to think that not only is it being cleaned up, but it's being put back into some sort of productive use, gives them something more positive to focus on in their community, and you know, as he said, it certainly generates a lot of enthusiasm once it starts. Next slide. All right, that's the end of our presentation. That's my contact information on it. You feel free to give me a call or send an email if you have any questions, and I'll coordinate with Leo. And Leo, I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to say as we're wrapping up here, or if we're ready to go on to the next presenter.
Yeah, just a final note. It's been a few years since I even looked at this site, and then Bill asked me, I guess, last week to join. One thing just popped into my mind. The original remedial design, RIFS process had the price tag on this site approaching $60 million originally. The total cleanup cost for this site will be less than half of that, and a lot of that is attributed to a wise incorporation of land use. I think that little statistic just really speaks volumes.
I think it does too, and you know, sometimes you know, for those that are with EPA out there, when you're trying to figure out how to design your remedy and, you know, thinking about funding of a remedy, sometimes you know, and with money being tighter and tighter, people, you know, want to cut back on things. But I certainly think reuse planning is worthwhile, especially if you can do it earlier in the process as it was done here, because it can result into some massive savings in your overall cleanup costs, just because you know what the site's going to be, so you know what your options can be as far as you know, conducting your remedy. It can really, really reduce those costs. Thanks, Leo. I appreciate that. That's
yeah, and thanks for the opportunity, guys. I appreciate
it. Yeah, really appreciate you coming in. A great success story, and a success story on the cooperation between emergency response and the remedial program, too.
Bill, this is Melissa. I want to thank you and Leo very much for giving the presentation. We did get a question that came in where someone was wondering, did the people in the community know that this was a Superfund site?
Yes, ma'am. It was a contentious environmental justice site at the time.
Okay. So you think people were pretty much aware of the fact that this had gone on and that it was a Superfund site in the past?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The community actually, you know, backs up to the site, and it's right across from the high school. I think I've never been there, but from what I understand, it's very visible.
Okay. We also got a question from the same person, but it's a very region-specific question. So since I have their email, I'm going to follow up with them offline. And I see we have another question. The site being cleared. Okay. I'll just read the question, and maybe you guys can take a crack at it. The site is being cleaned up to recreational use standards. What if during EPA's 5-year review there's a change to the toxicity in one of the contaminants of concern and you need to do additional remediation? For example, one of the site's contaminants of concern is dioxin. So if we changed our dioxin toxicity values, would we discuss this? How would we handle this with the community, and how would this work with the 5-year review process?
Well, there's I'm sure there's a greater program answer to that, but from a practical point of view, the soccer fields themselves are elevated with 3 to 4 feet worth of soil. So any residual, for instance, dioxin levels that are subsurface, will be a moot point because they're not in direct human contact. You'd have to continue. There are some land use restrictions that are part of the deal here, that they can't go below, X amount of feet for any kind of redevelopment use.
Okay.
In terms of the standards changing for direct contact for surface soils, Bill, I don't know what the program's plans are for that, but from a practical point of view, it doesn't really affect this particular site.
Right. I think, you know, that's very site-specific, you know, and 5-year review specific is, you know, like in this case, I mean, the standards may change and it may affect the overall cleanup. It may affect, you know, how residential yards are looked at or how other areas, but with the soil cover, I don't think there would be any impact to the recreational complex itself.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. I think now we can move on to Tom Bloom.
Yep. Hi, everybody. Tom Bloom here. I'm the Region 5 Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator here in Chicago. Today we're going to talk about the HOD landfill case study. I'm on slide 27, going to slide 28. A little background about the site. It's located in Antioch, Illinois, which is close to the Illinois-Wisconsin border, not too far from Lake Michigan. The entire parcel is 121 acres. It was part of the former, part of them, 121 acres, there was a 51-acre landfill, 40-acre borrow area. You can see from the aerial that's on the slide right now, and there's wetlands to the south of the seasonal wetlands to the south of the landfill. The landfill received waste for about 21 years, from 1963 on to 84. It was a commingled site where they had municipal and commercial and industrial wastes in there. Before I move off the slide, I just wanted everybody to pay attention to where Antioch High School is in the bottom left corner. And right to the right of the school is their little recreational area. You can barely see, there's two baseball diamonds there. That's all the school had for practice fields for their football, soccer, baseball teams. In addition to that, I want everybody to take a look at the Sequoia Acre Industrial Park, which is just a little bit north of there, the recreational fields. Right in the very bottom of that was a municipal well that came up with vinyl chloride in it when we were doing the remedial investigation. So let's move on to slide 29. Remedial activities out at the HOD landfill. Initially, the landfill was covered, was required covered by Illinois EPA 1989. They did a 708 cover that had involved clay with the sensitivity readings in it, so we couldn't have water flowing through into the landfill and out of the landfill. Once again, I mentioned that the vinyl chloride was discovered in one of the municipal wells. We shut that down right away there in the industrial park area. Selected a remedy that had to do with restoring the eroding cap that was out there. There were some leachate seeps that were visible from the breaks in the slopes on the sides of the landfill. The gas and leachate system needed to be upgraded. There was five or six flare units out on the landfill. There was leachate, like I said, not being collected properly, some seeping. Groundwater monitoring needed to be conducted. We went with a monitor natural attenuation to make sure that vinyl chloride was going to decrease instead of a pump and treat. And we wanted to implement institutional controls to address what we didn't take care of physically, like restrictions on groundwater use in the area. And initially, we wanted to get that site fenced because we didn't want people to get exposed to the leachate seeps and some of the concerns that were out there prior to the cleanup. Slide number 30. Okay, there we go. So, in this one, the reuse ideas came to us during the remedial design phase. We had selected the remedy. The mayor had talked to one of the major responsible parties out there, which was Waste Management's project manager, and they asked, what about a golf course out in the landfill? So, Waste Management had thought about, you know, recreational use. In addition to that, the school district had mentioned to the project manager for Waste Management that they were landlocked, that they needed practice fields, and suggested, what about, you know, a couple of practice fields, football fields up on top of the landfill? The western half of the landfill was filled shallow with 10 to 20 feet of material, and the eastern part was deep with about 80 feet of material. So the western part would be the best one for soccer fields or recreational fields, less subsidence that had been there for quite a while, less methane being produced from there. So that's kind of in the design. We reviewed their design, and we let them make changes in the design where they decided to make the slopes promote recreational use by making very flat slopes out there on the surface. We talked about them about flush mounting the sticks that were sticking up, flush mounting all the wells out there into vaults. And we talked about taking the five or six flare units that are there and putting into one central flare and one operation and maintenance area kind of off of the recreational fields. And so we kind of incorporated reuse planning into the design phase when we were putting together the remedial action design. Next slide would be 31. Reuse possibilities that came up initially, it was really the athletic fields for the high school. They were landlocked, and as you could see from that one aerial, they're right not down the street from the landfill. Prior to that, they were busing their kids to practice fields that were several miles away just to practice football and soccer and baseball. In addition to that, to the south of the landfill, there are some educational opportunities with the wetlands there. The school had seen that they wanted to take advantage of. And the methane cogeneration system kind of came up as an afterthought as we were going through the reuse planning. And when we looked at how much methane was going to be generated there, what was going to the flare, the school superintendent said, hey, what about, you know, piping some of that methane over to our boiler unit or to a generation unit on our facility and letting us heat the school and maybe use the hot water for, you know, the hot water concerns in the school. Slide number 32. So the big challenge out there was really site stigma. You can see this fence up here, and there's warning signs on the fence. early, you know, initially we were telling the public, yeah, we think it could be reused for recreational uses, but then the public would drive by the site and see the big fence up there with the skull and crossbones and saying, hey, this is you're contradicting yourself. You're saying you think it's safe for recreational reuses and you've got big fences, barbed wire and skull and crossbone signs. It doesn't really make sense. Additionally, there was in some of the institutional controls that talked about the site fencing had to be there. That was a restriction. We couldn't get up there and do any activities on the calf at the time. Some of the other challenges had to do with, you know, the stakeholders out there, the township, the village, and the school district. Certainly the school district needed recreational use and practice fields. The township would have wanted to use the borrow area for a park in the later future. And initially the village wanted to go, the mayor liked the idea of a golf course out there. So we had, you know, some conflicting uses there. But kind of the way that we dealt with it was by phasing in the uses. We said, well, we think we can have the school out. We can get it ready to go for recreational uses first. And when we move off that, we can move into the borrow area and flatten that out and maybe make a park out there for the village. And the eastern portion of the landfill that was still settling, well, that doesn't sound bad for a driving range or a golf course because it's okay if the slopes get a little bit different from time to time. And then additionally, there was the funding for the reuse, the facilitation services and the coordination, bringing everybody together and then dealing with some of the challenges were also an issue. Slide 33. Key stakeholders out there, Community High School, Village of Antioch, the community definitely, soccer moms were involved, Antioch Township, Waste Management of Illinois, that was the main responsible party out there, the coal site management group did a great job at this facility. Region 5 and also our headquarters got involved in it. So those were some of our key stakeholders out there. Slide number 34. So what we did was to address the stigma, you know, some of the locals there had heard that there was methyl ethyl death dumped up there for years and years, and they did not want anybody going on that property. They didn't want their kids playing soccer out there. So we had to do an educational process to the people to let them know that we looked at the exposure scenarios. We were going to try to, you know, we were going to definitely abate them and make sure that there wasn't any unacceptable exposures being done out there. And a lot of it kind of also comes out of the last talk, you know, bringing them together, getting some accountability, getting them involved in being part of the solution and not necessarily fighting against the problems that were out there. We also, you know, it helped us by get information gathering from them to identify some of the barriers that EPA had put in place, one being this large fence with the barbed wire and skull and crossbones, and here we're telling them that it would be okay for recreational uses. Slide number 35. One of the ideas that we came up with to deal with the site stigma was the Ready for Reuse document, which is an environmental conditions report. It's not a legal documentation. It just puts together what was done at the site, what could be done with the site, some general terms that it's okay for recreational reuse. In the small print there, it tells you who's going to be in charge of maintaining the site, what can be done, what can't be done out there. But that went a long way to help with the stigma concerns out there because the EPA was issuing a report that was written in layman's terms that people could understand that said the site was okay for recreational reuses. And even though it's not a non-legal document, it still went through our Office of Regional Council for approval to make sure that we're not saying something in there that could be taken wrong. Next slide, number 36. Next thing that came out to help with the challenges out there was an ESD. I wrote an explanation of significant differences out there. And one of them had to do with addressing the fence. Once we put the remedy in place, the fence was no longer needed for protectiveness to keep people away from leachate seeps. In addition to that, you know, some of the institutional control language says no activities on the landfill cap, no intrusions into the landfill cap. So we kind of rewrote those so that we could leave temporary intrusions into the landfill cap, but we wanted to know what was done with the material brought up, how they were going to address the health and safety of the workers working on the landfill caps, and how are they going to button it back up to ensure the integrity of the landfill cap after they put in fencing and posts like you see in this slide right here. Slide number 37. Here's another write-up on the ESD that was written up there. Once again, I said, you know, we could remove the original fence, which the park district didn't really want to do. They took down the barbed wire, they took down the skull and crossbone signs, but they'd like to keep their park secured. So even though we allowed them to do that, they didn't necessarily do it. They just modified that. What I also wanted to do was make sure that those vaults that were outside of the main operation and maintenance area that were flush mounted were locked down. So, you know, if kids were out there playing, they see a little vault in the ground, they're not going to goof around with trying to pry open the cap to see what's underneath it. And then when they moved all the flare units to one collection center and one flare unit building, and that area was fenced and was required to have, you know, signs saying this is the operation and maintenance area. So we still had our protection and we still had our operation and maintenance equipment secured, knowing that there would be recreational users on the site. Slide number 38. Reuse coordination was big here. We had several meetings with the locals to educate them as to what was done out at the site, what we found out the site, some of our investigation processes. We wanted their input into it too. We didn't just come out there and say, this is what we think could be done. We did like brainstorming sessions. What do you think, you know? Golf course, soccer, football, what would you like to have done out there? So that kind of also brought them into the process, made them feel like part of the team. And I think it worked out pretty well in the end. Slide number 39. Funding for the reuse came from some of it came from waste management. They went and found some non-settling responsible parties and asked for some donations from them. Waste management chipped in some money also. State of Illinois gave some grants for the cogeneration plant design, and the U.S. Soccer Foundation supported with field design and equipment design for soccer use afterwards. Slide number 40. That's what the site looked like before reuse. However, I got to tell you, this is what the site looked like after our remedial action construction was complete. Prior to that, it was undulating with flare stacks all up and down and seeps sticking out the sides of it. It didn't look nearly as nice as this. Slide number 41. Afterwards, you can see we've got soccer fields out there. We've got the Tim Osman Sports Complex. There's a playground out there for the kids. There's more to come. Slide number 42. McMillan Park. This, I believe, is part of the borrow. No, this isn't borrow. This is part of the landfill area where we've got. Now we've got our practice fields for the football team. I didn't know there's a difference between a practice field and a real field that they play on, but some of these fields are just designed for practice. There's a girls' softball league out there. There's some fantastic recreational opportunities right down the street from where the school is so that everybody can use it. Slide number 43. The cogen plant came up a little bit later on. RMT, which was the operation and maintenance contractor for waste management, had partnered with the school superintendent to apply for a grant from Illinois to think about this cogeneration plant. It cost about $9 million to make, to set it up. It was a fairly resource-intensive endeavor where they had to have a waste management did not want to pipe anything but pure methane over to the school's parking lot for the cogeneration plant. So they had to put chillers on site. They had to clean the gas before it left the facility. They had to put a pipeline in that's about a mile and a half long from the operation and maintenance area's collection point to the cogeneration plant in the parking lot of the school, jacking under Sequoia Creek and a set of railroad tracks. There was a lot of neat stuff that came out of it, though. That picture on the right-hand side, when I went to a public meeting, that was a to-scale picture showing everybody that for a child to get exposed to the waste down below, that's the blue area, they'd have to dig through all that material there. That was one of the things that we did with the stigma concerns. When we were at public meetings, mothers sat up there and said, I'm not letting my kid play soccer on that field unless it's 110% safe. somebody else in the audience would say, well, it wasn't 110% safe for you to drive to this meeting tonight. But we wanted to educate everybody to let them know that, you know, there's no way their child is going to be able to get through 3 feet of compressed clay on, in addition to that, you know, some of the 18 inches of topsoil and all everything that's above them to ever get exposed to the waste down below. Waste management, we were also concerned about maybe positive pressure at leach, if there's a catastrophic failure of the leachate collection system and the gas system went down. They turned it off for 48 hours to see if we ever went positive, just to see if that could be a possibility. Never happened. So that was some of the neat stuff that came out of it. Educational opportunities was great, too. The school set up a science curriculum. They have kids monitoring environmental data out there. We've got field trips to the cogeneration plant and to the site for kids that are interested in environmental careers at the high school. You can see our little design for a bench over the collection well systems on some of the areas that we have on the site. Slide number 44. So lessons learned, well, just because we got it cleaned up doesn't necessarily equal that it, everything's done out there. I mean, we could have it cleaned up and chained up and nobody's using it, and it doesn't help the community much. We can be a barrier, putting up an institutional control that says you must have a fence with barbed wire and telling the public that recreational use would be okay kind of is contradicting yourself. And then also reuse and O&M can go hand in hand, that, you know, long-term stewardship, having people out at the site, they help each other out, they feel like they're part of the process. Slide number 45. Now, there's my contact information. I can talk about the site all day. Just give me a call if you want to know more about it. It was a very interesting project. Took a little while to get it together, but we've been having great success out there, and it's a good example of what happens when everybody thinks about what they can do and not what they can't do. And now I think I'm turning it over to Chris.
Tom, before you do that, can we check in to see if anyone has any questions?
Of course.
At this point, I guess we'll offer up our folks listening on the phone to speak up if they have any questions. So you can take your phone off mute and ask your question. If you used your keypad, if you hit pound 6, that will unmute your phone. And I'll also remind folks, if you use the question bar icon above the slides, you can submit a question at any time. Okay, I'm not hearing anyone speak up with questions, and we're not getting anything online. So, we can move on to the next presentation on slide 46. Chris Thomas.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm Chris Thomas. I'm the team leader of our land revitalization team in Region 3, and I'm going to talk to you today about the Aptex NPL site, which is located in Front Royal, Virginia. I just want to mention that of all the sites in Region 3, and I was involved with this on and off for a while, this was an industrial apocalypse out here. This was one of the, you could have filmed a movie out here. This site was so bad. Hopefully when I run through, you'll see why we are so very proud of the reuse efforts that came out of the back end of this. And I'll just start off with a little background here. Again, it's located in Front Royal, Virginia. It's 440 acres. It's on the South Fork of the Shenandoah River. It was the largest manufacturer of rayon in the United States. It was built on the South Fork of the Shenandoah River by the American Viscose Corporation sometime in the late 1930s. Began really heavily operating in 1940. During World War II, it manufactured most of the parachutes and jumpsuits for the Defense Department. And obviously, all the waste associated with that, which we will get into. FMC Corporation purchased the plant in 1963. And they later contracted with NASA to produce synthetic fibers for the space program. I heard they were making the skin for the outside of the space shuttles. That was really the only thing that they were making at the end of their operation there. Aptex Fiber Incorporated purchased the plant from FMC in 1976 and they continue manufacturing operations until the plant's abrupt closing in 1989. At its peak, the plant had employed over 2,500 people. And at the time, Front Royal was not quite the Washington suburb that it is today. It was a very small, isolated area. I was first there in the late 80s, early 90s, and this entire closing of this site had a huge, bad economic downturn for the entire area here. Again, 2,500 people in a small town is a lot of people. This site, as I mentioned, was large and really nasty. I want to give you some of the history of what was found out there.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We're getting a lot of feedback from somebody's phones. If everyone could just make sure the phone is on mute if you're not speaking. Sorry about that, Chris.
No, it's okay. I want to give you a little history of what was found out there. The plant manufacturing operation, they generated three major types of waste. The first type was generated from the waste acid from the production process and was treated with lime in the wastewater treatment plant. So you had your pH swings in the process from high to the pH to the alkaline end. And the metal bearing sludge generated by that treatment, they put in six sulfate basins. Second waste type was fly ash generated from the combustion of coal. They had their own power plant, because of the size of this plant, they had their own power source. And the fly ash was disposed in four impoundments in one stockpile. All told, there are 23 impoundments on the site, and the fill areas covered 220 acres. If you look at that little picture up there in the site background, you see the south fork of the Shenandoah on the left, and to the right of that, which is to the east of the river, you kind of see a line. That's the railroad there, Norfolk Southern Railroad. Actually separated to the right of that was the operations area, and all that to the left was the waste disposal and treatment area. So you can see the magnitude of the waste disposal area there. The third waste type was waste viscose that was disposed in 11 on-site basins. And this waste viscose was primarily an off-spec production from the production process. In addition, they put solid waste in on-site waste landfill that had a permit from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Now, all the waste in there, there was a heavy metals and PCBs is a big problem out here, and carbon disulfide, which is, as you all know, is quite dangerous. Lead, zinc, mercury, nickel, PCBs, your wild pH swings, and your carbon disulfide were your big waste of concern out here. See, the next slide is slide 48, please. Okay. The site was added to the Superfund NPL list in 1986. The plant was abandoned in 1989. I'll get into that in a minute about how that came to be. And EPA initiated removal and remedial actions at that time. The cleanup activities included the removal of the contaminated soil, building demolition, treatment of the debris and the removal of the sewer line, and some landfill consolidation and capping. Those proposed cleanup options for the site's groundwater and surface were contamination off-site disposal basins. Just want to give you a little bit more of the history of this site and why it became so dangerous. In 1989, the Virginia State Water Control Board pulled the plant's NPDES water permit. Subsequently, Aptex abandoned operations. They just walked away from the facility at that point. And remember, it's carbon disulfide in that wastewater treatment plant in the impoundments, plus all your heavy metal concentrations, PCBs, and your pH issues as well. To give you a little background, what was removed from this site during the early years, highlights of EPA's emergency and removal response included transferring of approximately 2,000 tons of various chemicals for recycling reuse, the on-site and off-site treatment of an estimated 241,000 gallons of flammable and corrosive chemicals. That's a lot of chemicals. EPA had to keep operating the wastewater treatment plant because that was treating the discharge before it went into the Shenandoah River. There were 22 of the impoundments contained carbon disulfide. You treated approximately 992,000 of carbon disulfide wastewater, and they removed approximately 1,300 cubic yards of carbon disulfide sludge and disposed of 320 cubic yards of contaminated soils from those carbon disulfide basins. And in addition, there are 33 large capacity storage tanks that were drained as well. Early on as part of this action, EPA managed over 770,000 gallons of hazardous and non-hazardous liquids and 320 cubic yards of soil. So you can see it was quite the challenge out here. Between 89 and 1998, EPA was the lead environmental organization out here. Again, we removed, one of the problems was the buildings were so contaminated, and I was in this plant when I was working in private industry. It was probably the worst operating plant I had ever seen. There were all kind of OSHA issues. There was actually a worker or two killed in the production process. Again, this was at the end when they were just making some materials for NASA, and they apparently weren't putting any capital investment back into the plant. It was really a hellhole. So EPA, of course, the buildings were so contaminated that you see in that picture, removed 740,000 square feet of building space, addressed the water quality issues, and removed tons of hazardous substances. The big action was focusing on operating the wastewater treatment system to protect the South Fork of the Shenandoah River. And you stand up on that bluff right there, it's a beautiful part of the country there. Apparently before it was Aftex, it was just orchards. Again, this all leads into how proud we are of having this site put back into reuse and cleaned up. It's a beautiful part of the country there. There were process lines that hadn't been evacuated, all kinds of vessels, pressure vessels, all the laboratory materials were still there. There's a waste treatment complex, which was, as you can imagine, quite nasty. And the severe deterioration of the 17 acres of the manufacturing process area led EPA to determine that cleanup activities would be best accomplished by large-scale mechanical demolition of the buildings to remove the remaining chemical residuals. All in all, there's the site was broken up into 10 Superfund operable units. There's been four rods for the site to date, one ESD. A good part of this demolition process was, when I was there babysitting one time, they were actually separating the reusable material brick by brick when they were tearing down these facilities. So they did take a lot of material out there and reuse it. Let's see. In 1999, FMC entered into a consent decree with EPA. Now you are the PRP lead out there. They segregate and characterize demolition debris and waste materials generated during EPA's demolition activities. Most of these materials were either cleaned for reuse on site or transported off site for recycling or disposal. The material that could not be treated successfully and determined that it was not to be reused had to be disposed of, obviously, off site for proper disposal. FMC decontaminated the remaining above ground buildings and excavated the sewer lines, which when the plant was evacuated, were full. Next slide, please. Slide 49. At the top there, I just want to call your attention to this. You see this map up here. This actually came out of their concept plan for site reuse, which I'll talk about just a little bit later. Just get you oriented here. You see the South Fork of the Shenandoah on the lower part of that plan there. In the upper right corner, you see kind of two rectangles and two trapezoid-type areas there. That's the area that we put the soccer fields. That's where the soccer fields were placed. So just to give you a little bit of orientation, just so you know what we're talking about here. Again, this plant is massive. The wastewater treatment plant is to the lower left. And the groundwater was contaminated under the Shenandoah River and was detected in wells on the other side. So there was a drinking water issue here as well. It was anything that could go wrong environmentally was found at this facility. I didn't want to mention that. I think EPA used every available tool in the Superfund toolbox. We did time-critical removal actions, non-time-critical actions, obviously Superfund lead and PRP lead actions as well. So we really used every tool here to get this site cleaned up. Got to the point where in 1998, the town of Front Royal, Warren County, and the Economic Development Authority, they got together. The town and the county were they saw the potential of this site, again, losing 2,500 people, 2,500 jobs, was an incentive to get this back in some sort of good reuse. They had an 8-month public participation process in conjunction with the North American Realty Advisory Services, and they prepared a comprehensive plan for the site's redevelopment and reuse. All told, these organizations put up $175,000 in the process to get this reuse plan going. These local organizations then continued the multi-stage public participation process to address each of the comprehensive plan's elements. They did use, during this process, the Standard Guide to the Process of Sustainable Brownfields Development. That's the ASTM guidance document that is on their website. I looked up today. It's still there. The guide offers an adaptable framework that actively engages property owners, developers, and government agencies and the community in conducting economic evaluation, design, and reuse plans for this site. Between fall of 99 and the spring of 2000, there were 8 multi-stakeholder group meetings that were held to prepare part of the plan. If you see the green area on that, the map on the slide there, it's a 240-acre proposed. It is going to be used for mainly open space, not recreational, but due to what's going to be left there. Again, a lot of these landfills were consolidated. It's going to be parkland, basically a... It's not going to be used for soccer fields. So you'll see that bottom plan there. And part of the green, it looks like it's a somewhat wetlandish looking area. That's not going to be, at this point, a functional area. We don't want too many people walking around. In fact, there was a meeting to the left of the soccer fields at the top, 170 acres of the site is going to be set aside for a business park. Let's see, slide 50. Thank you. It's on the other side of the room there, having trouble seeing the numbers there. But anyway, you see the next slide, you actually see the picture of the Apex Soccerplex. And this is where we wanted to go with this. Throughout all this remediation processes and everything else, all the work being done out here by EPA, the state, the county, EDA, and the locals, there was a plan underway with all these multi-stakeholder meetings to develop this Soccerplex. September of 2006 was the opening of this 33-acre Skyline Soccerplex, the first part of the redevelopment for this site. I know at the time that one of the biggest needs for Warren County Parks and Recreation was having an adequate and permanent facility for soccer leagues. It wasn't really a facility that could handle the demand that the locals wanted for their youth and adult soccer leagues there. It took the county, town, the Economic Development Authority, and EPA, and U.S. Soccer Foundation, and FMC Corporation working as one to finally get this finished. U.S. Soccer Foundation was a huge player here. They donated $10,000 to the first phase of the project and provided expertise in supporting the design of the facility. EPA Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, throw a bone to you guys, named Apex one of its pilots and provided a $100,000 pilot grant to support the reuse of this site. Next slide, please, 51. Now, the Soccerplex was the first part of what had been planned for the reuse of this site. And again, that was opened in 2006. The other pieces are still falling somewhat in place. See those pictures at the top there. Again, this is on the South Fork of Shenandoah. It's a beautiful wildlife area. And part of the site will be dedicated for that use. The one building that they left standing, you see right there, that's the old headquarters building. That is going to be redesigned as a green building. There's going to be 670 acres total out of this site. They're going to add additional acreage around the original 440, which is going to include the business park, 183 acres, hopefully a high-tech area, 126 acres, hotel and conference center, 22 acres, commercial use, 10 acres, recreational, that's your soccer fields and other things. It's actually a little higher than that because the soccer fields are 33 acres. And the wildlife refuge, 241 acres. And if you look at that previous slide, you'll see them, that even goes to the other side of the river somewhat as well. And another development, secondary park, is 71 acres. The Economic Development Authority is moving forward with redevelopment efforts for 160 acre industrial park east of the railroad tracks. Remember I showed you that slide of railroad tracks and a nature conservation area west of the tracks, which I showed you on that map earlier. EDA selected the former EdTech's administration building in that picture as a demonstration model to set the green standard for the development of the entire industrial park. Various sustainable and renewable strategies have been implemented, including natural lighting, low VOC paints and finishes. I'm going to say this one wrong. It's Mickey Young. Can you help me out with it?
Xeriscaping,
yeah. Which I had to look up today. I wasn't too familiar with that. It's reducing the need for supplemental water. So when they replant the vegetation out here, they're going to try to use that and some other techniques as well. The EDA, which is the Economic Development Authority, they're going to be the first tenants in that renovated building that we see up top there. They actually did move some of the offices in there in April 2002. So we have the soccer fields and that piece of the site reused at this time. The renovation of the entire 440-acre mixed-use complex is scheduled for completion by 2013. That's an ambitious plan. Obviously, in this economy, things may have slowed down a little bit. But that's where it stands at this point. Next slide, please. 52. I have my short-distance glasses on. I can't see that slide. Lessons learned. Again, we learned a lot of lessons during the environmental actions out here from a technical standpoint, but also huge lessons learned from trying to reuse the site. What was successful here is the locals were involved from the get-go, and there's no way this was ever going to happen without the locals getting in on the ground floor on this. The community's got to be involved early as possible in the creation of the vision for the reuse of a site of this magnitude. A vision must be created by a broad range of stakeholders, must be championed by local elected officials, which this really was. The county and local people were wonderful. Second, contaminated sites are complex. Obviously, this site was complex due to the severe nature of the waste stream there. Just to let you know, FMC Corporation is still on the hook out there. The site's actions are not yet completed. The reuse resources have to be secured from a variety of local, state, and federal agencies if they're going to be reused, if the site's going to be reused successfully. Efforts must be made to assemble an intergovernmental team that meets regularly to evaluate project needs. Up front, there were 8 multi-agency meetings to figure out a reuse plan for this site, and those meetings continue to this day. The community has a wonderful website. You go on EPA Region 3's website, and you tap into our Superfund cleanup site, hit Aptex Fibers, and in those pages, you have a prompt for the local page. And they've got a nice history of the site up there and some other things, and the entire conceptual plan for the site is on there as well. So they've done a great job getting all that information. They actually have an aerial map that you click on that 8 times, and it shows it back from the 1930s to the present. So that gives you a really nice view of what's been happening, there. It's basically all I have. I don't know if anybody has any questions at this point.
If there's anyone on the phone line that wants to speak up and ask a question, you can unmute your phone at this point. If you use the keypad to mute your phone, you can unmute it by hitting #6.
Okay, if there's no questions, I guess I'm going to turn it over to Greg Griffiths from the U.S. Soccer Foundation, and they were huge in getting this site reused. Greg?
Thank you. Hi, my name's Greg Griffith. I'm with the U.S. Soccer Foundation. If you will go to start at slide 54, so if you go down 2 slides, you'll see the U.S. Soccer Foundation and our role. We're the major charitable arm of soccer in the United States. And some of you might be saying, why would we want to create a soccer field? just wanted to point out some possible reasons why you would want to. First, it's the world's most popular game, and It's actually the second most popular game by participation in the United States. In some communities, like where I live in Northern Virginia, more children play soccer than all the other sports combined. So there is demand for soccer fields in the United States. Soccer is a very growing in popularity as well. For example, the Seattle Sounders, the professional soccer team in Seattle, sells more tickets than the Seattle Seahawks professional football team does now. So it's growing in popularity, and again, the demand for field space is growing as well. It's also one of very popular because boys and girls like to play it equally well, and you know, our women's national team has done extremely well, and we're very proud of our women in the sport. If you go to the next slide, 55, what we've done so far, as several of the speakers mentioned, we've been involved with some of these projects before. We've been involved with them because we have a grants program, and our grants program, you can see the information that's listed on there, but we have a grants program in the spring which provides planning grants. So if you're interested in doing these projects, you can get some assistance in planning a recreational facility and soccer fields. And in the fall, in October, we have what we call our annual grants process, in which you can get money for to build a synthetic field, field turf field that's top of the line. That's what they use in the Meadowlands Stadium in New York, for example. We have lighting grants, we have irrigation grants, and we have money for goals and other things like that. So we have grants that are available that can help assist your projects. And that's what we've used to assist some of the projects that have been talked about. I also wanted to mention that the reason we do this is because we believe in the power of the game, and we believe that using soccer to connect with kids is a great way to get them to exercise. And also, there's a lot of information out there that says that exercise really helps kids perform better in school. It helps their behavior. It helps their performance in school, their brain activity, and it helps their attendance in school. And those three things are three of the four things that make sure that kids graduate. The other is, you know, a strong household environment. So if you go to the next slide, which is 56, we're now engaged in national priorities, and there's a picture there of the First Lady at one of our soccer clinics. She used a soccer clinic we were holding in Washington, D.C. last March to launch her Let's Move campaign, and she wanted to use that because soccer is an activity where kids run around a lot. And there's another advantage to sports in general and soccer in that there's a mentoring gap out there. Underserved youth who only have one parent in their life are really lacking mentors, and the Department of Justice has identified about 18 million children that need mentors, and through all the efforts of Big Brothers Big Sisters and other mentoring organizations, they're only reaching 3 million of those right now. So it's really up to coaches who can mentor a team full of kids at one time to help make up that gap, and we're getting involved with mentoring youth who are from underserved communities. And many of these sites that we're talking about are in underserved communities, whether they be rural or urban areas. If you go to the next page, it's titled Places to Play. It's slide 57. Places to play are so important to the health of our youth. If kids don't have places to play, then they become obese, and obesity is affecting one in three children in our society right now, and it's a major problem. And if kids don't have a place to play, then they start to get in trouble, and places that don't have places to play for youth experience higher juvenile crime rates. And so by building fields and soccer fields, like we said, appeals to boys and girls and has a high popularity. It helps give kids an outlet and keeps them safe and out of trouble and gives them exercise, and as well as providing that adult mentor in their life. So these places to play are very important, and they're just as important in city as rural communities and suburban communities. If you go to the next slide, it's 58. This is an example of a field that was being used in Los Angeles. This is underserved community in Los Angeles, and they didn't have any money to renew their field. And we provided a grant, if you go to slide 59, to rebuild their field and create a great synthetic turf field. It's field turf. It's top of the line. It's warranted for 10 years. And this type of field can be used as a cap on a Superfund project. One of the other speakers mentioned that because of the subsurface that's underneath these fields, it really does cap very well the Superfund sites. This field in Los Angeles is used about 14 hours a day. It's lighted, it's used almost constantly. So another example of why you would do that. If you go to the next site, next slide, which is 60, this is a site that's in Harlem, at the Children's Aid Society in Harlem. We helped create a field in an underused vacant lot in Harlem. This field is about the size of a tennis court, all the way to the fences. But you can see for small kids, you can get a lot of use out of this. And this is an example, deviating a little bit from this topic, but where if there was a brown field in an urban area that needed redevelopment, it could potentially be developed in this way. And again, that's field turf. You can see how it's very soft and cushy. It's actually, a lot of kids like playing on it better than they like grass now. And we have a partnership with Field Turf, who helps subsidize the cost of these fields. But they last for 10 years, and very little maintenance is required, so they can be played, you know, 14 hours a day, and they don't wear out, unlike grass fields. If you go to the next slide, 61, just an example. So we were involved with the Front Royal site. We've been involved with a couple of the other Superfund sites, and we're very interested in helping create soccer fields. Wanted to mention again the planning grants and the field grants. If you go to the next slide, just an example of a field that was built with funding and planning from the U.S. Soccer Foundation. And I think the quote here on this slide, on slide 62, is very appropriate. It's very similar to other fields that we built, that when you build a field, it really brings the community together. If it's built right, it not only gives the kids a place to play, but while the kids are playing, the adults will be walking around, and you can see this is a really attractive area, and, you know, parents coming out to watch their kids can see the scenery as well. So I think that's a really good example of what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a place that the community can bring in, and you can see that this field is not only line for soccer, but it's also line has the numbers for football, and that can be the case as well. The thing about one of the reasons why we promote soccer is not only with the U.S. Soccer Foundation, but soccer is played, you know, multiple games a week, and it, like I said, it can be played just about every day, and whereas football tends to be played one game a week and only by boys. So there's a little less opportunity to play on if you just build a football field and you don't line it for soccer. So we feel that if you're going to build a field, you might as well build it for soccer and maybe lacrosse and football as well. And really that's all I had for my presentation. The next slide has my contact information. If you're interested in learning about our grants, you can go to our website, which is ussoccerfoundation.org. Or you can email me directly, or feel free to call me if you have specific questions. Full disclosure, I used to work for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, so that organization was involved at actually some of these projects as well, and so I have some idea of what you're talking about when you talk to me about Superfund and other sites. So I'll pause for questions and gladly take any.
Great, thanks, Greg. I just want to remind folks on the phone, you can take your phones off mute and ask your questions. You can hit #6 to unmute your phone if you're using the keypad. And I also want to encourage you all to go to slide 65 and please fill out our feedback form on the seminar with any ideas you might have for future webinars, any comments you had on today's webinar. And then also continue to use the orange question mark icon at the top of the slides in order to submit some questions online.
Yeah, Greg, we do have a question for you. Someone has asked, could a soccer field be used as a football practice field or vice versa? And do you know of any examples of having multiple use fields?
Sure, that Leedville field is an example. In the slide 62, you see that the field there is lined for football and soccer and lacrosse, I think. So, yeah, there's multiple examples of multiple use fields.
Hey, Greg, this is Tom Bloom in Chicago. I've got a question. It has to do with the capital cost of building, like, an artificial turf field against maybe a natural turf field. I was thinking there's probably pros and cons. One is the capital cost of an artificial field is probably more right up front. But when you talk about all the operation and maintenance that goes into maintaining a natural turf field, there's probably a certain time afterwards where that levels out and you actually are more cost effective to put an artificial turf field in. Is that maybe true?
Thanks, Tom. That's a great question. Absolutely. We feel that way, that the use that you get out of an artificial turf field greatly outweighs the use that you can get out of the grass field. And over the course of 10 years, the cost to maintain that grass field and to be able to use it less is about the same as installing the synthetic turf field. Now, synthetic turf field requires more cost up front. So a high top-of-the-line 10-year warranty field like field turf is between $800,000 and $1 million. And so that's a huge upfront cost. And many communities cannot afford that. But maintaining a great condition grass field costs about $100,000 a year. So if you use the 10 years, you're spending about the same amount of money over a 10-year period, and you can play on synthetic turf field, rain or shine, 24 hours a day if you wanted to, and the field will be just as perfect. Whereas if you did that on a grass field, in about 6 months, you would have no grass anymore.
It also has to be an advantage for the locals that have to maintain it. I know I work with a lot of park districts, and they're like, well, you know, we don't want to have to go out and maintain another, you know, field. And this would be a pro for them, because you could say artificial turf field, you don't have to necessarily take your level of effort from what you're doing now with the Parks and Recs Department and have to turn it towards this new field. So I imagine that's a good point, too, there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. That's the maintenance is virtually nothing once you put the field in.
That's great. Thank you.
Greg, we have another question. Someone has asked, do you have any concerns about gas emissions on the playing surfaces?
I think that would be a better question for Tom or one of the to answer. What we work with them, and they give us the sign off on whether it's good to go. So any of you guys want to answer that?
Yeah, I know we looked at it at the HOD landfill. I mentioned it earlier. You know, one of our risk assessors said, what if there's a catastrophic failure of the gas collection system? Would there be methane, terminating through the pore spaces under the field and up into the players above that? And that's why, just to prove a point, Waste Management turned the system off for a couple of days to see if we would go positive. We never did. But a lot of times we have a barrier between the waste and the material, too. So, I mean, when you put a cap on, and it's a permeable cap, you're going to look at lateral migration of methane anyway. So I don't think it would make a big difference if you're going to put a cap on and it's going to be a soccer field, or if you're going to put a cap on and it's going to be an impermeable cap. You still have to look, as a project manager, to the fact that gas, once you cap that surface, could laterally migrate, and we look at that in our engineering designs, and we try to we account for that.
Okay, Greg, we got another question for you if you're willing.
Sure.
You said that someone's asking. You said several times throughout your presentation that artificial fields last for 10 years. So, do the artificial fields need to be replaced after 10 years, or is there some type of maintenance program that's required after 10 years?
That's a great question. So I mentioned that FieldSurf, the company that we partner with, they have a 10-year warranty on it. So they guarantee that the field will be in great condition or they'll fix it for 10 years. Most people find that the fields last 12 to 15 years. However, when it does need to be replaced, there is the surface that you see is only a portion of the whole synthetic field. There's under surface, there's actually concrete with drainage underneath it, and so you don't need to replace all that. So the cost of the turf itself is closer to, $200,000 to $250,000 to replace after 10 years rather than having to do the whole project. So it might be maybe $300,000 to replace it rather than do a full new project. And then that should last another 10 years.
Do we have any other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank all our presenters for doing such a great job. And, Greg, I want to thank you especially for coming as a non-EPA person to join our seminar, and I appreciate all the questions that you guys have answered so thoughtfully. And I'd like to invite you to join our next webinar, which will be held on March 21st. So look for information coming out about that. I want to thank our moderator, and we can certainly email any of us if you have any more questions once the presentation's over. So thank you all.
Thank you, everyone.